Hello, and welcome to The Double Pivot, the world's most agreeable soccer analytics podcast. I am Michael Cayley. We are back. The Premier League season is winding down, and this happened before, and you don't sort of think about it exactly as you are working through all of the excitement about talking about a title race and the various other challenges. But now we're having it happen again, where having a title race, having two teams locked very closely in competition, is just fundamentally a, well, will one of them drop points or not story? And it becomes, as there get to be fewer and fewer games, you get to have a smaller amount of time to really talk about the averages and the expectations, and it's just like, well, did they drop points? No? Okay, next week. Like, it has less and less to analyze as these games go on, unless there were a head-to-head match, which, you know, the head-to-head matches already happened. We didn't get that. So, instead, we're just going to start talking about some teams. And some of these teams have made major decisions, some of these teams have had interesting seasons, and where better to start than with Liverpool, the best team not in the title race, who have made a whole bunch of major decisions recently. And who better to talk about Liverpool with than with Grace Robertson of the Grace on Football newsletter and the Trevote Discord. So we have a lot to talk about. I am joined by Mike Goodman as well as Grace, and yeah, Liverpool time, huh?
Let's do it. The music here on the way in as well. Please download, subscribe, make us happy as podcasters. Patreon.com/doublepivot. Hang out in the Discord. It's all three of our Discord. It's great. There's, I don't know, I went into the actual soccer part of the Discord to talk about soccer today, and people were talking about Saudi Arabia and the line. So, you know, I swear there is plenty of soccer generally to talk about. I know for the Liverpool sickos among you, Grace, there is like a squirreled away thread in somewhere where all the Liverpool sickos get into all the Liverpool minutia, and maybe some discussion of this podcast will live.
It's quite funny how as soon as the title race went wrong, everyone either switched talking about what's going to happen with the manager or just complete nonsense that has nothing to do with football. Like, no one in the Liverpool chat wants to talk about this season anymore. It's completely switched over.
Well, we do nothing if we do not do fan service journalism. So let's talk about the next Liverpool manager. Actually, before we get to the person who is going to be the next Liverpool manager, let's talk about somebody who is not going to be the next Liverpool manager, or for that matter, the next manager of West Ham. And that's Ruben Amorim, who I seem to recall you not particularly being enamored of as a prospective Liverpool manager.
Yeah, I think he's... Maybe I'm just prejudiced against Portuguese managers after years of watching Jose Mourinho sides, but he, from everything I've read, he's very, very set in his specific ideas of playing a 3-4-3 and not having, I don't know what I would consider great ideas about progressing the ball into the final third and being kind of very, like, I don't know, very, very, very disciplined about certain ideas. Probably a big fan of tactical periodization. Just that, I don't know, maybe I'm just sick of Portuguese football in general, and the nation of Portugal won't like me very much, but I don't know, I'm sure he would have been fine for West Ham, I'm sure he's good, like, I'm sure he's got good things going based on his success at Sporting, but I don't know, he seemed like a poor fit for Liverpool.
I will say one thing that sort of jumped out to me about Amorim is there's a difference between having good ideas and being good at implementing ideas. And Amorim struck me as a guy, as a manager, who is really good at implementing what he wants to do, who is really good at, you know, getting players on the same page with his plan, working together, understanding their roles, understanding their responsibilities. He did not necessarily strike me as a guy who had great ideas.
The reporting was that Liverpool didn't like that he was unwilling to be flexible about his 3-4-3 system, which seemed like he was going in and saying, like, these are the perfect ways to play football. This is what I'm going to be doing, and I'm not going to be changing it for any reason. And Liverpool were like, well, maybe we're not convinced that your ideas are completely amazing?
Yeah, if you're going to have those sorts of limitations on what you can do, like, formation-wise, and then just telling the team that is hiring you, like, well, you need to sign the players that do this, whatever it is that you have players that do right now, like, that is a really high bar to cross. The ideas have to then not merely be good enough for a top-level team, which is already a high bar, but, like, good enough for a top-level team to throw out a big chunk of their recruitment strategy and their retention strategy. And that's a really high level. The other thing here that both of you talked about is the way that because of the deep inequities of football, that there are, it appears, qualitative differences in what teams should be looking for in a manager at different levels. And that in particular, it is exceptionally hard to win at the highest level without a whole lot of ideas about what to do with the ball. And you can win at a pretty high level without a ton of ideas about what to do with the ball. Unai Emery does not have a ton of ideas about what to do with the ball, and he's going to be in the Champions League, and he's won some Europa Leagues. Like, that's a very high level. And yet, when we're talking about teams with title-winning ambitions in the Premier League, we're mostly looking at teams that I think reasonably, and I would like to see this demonstrated, I'd like to figure out how to demonstrate it. I want to sort of think through how you would, like, affirmatively make the case that this is true beyond that it sort of seems true and I can describe it around me. But it seems like someone like Amorim, who not only being locked in this 3-4-3 is a problem, but who really does want his team to, you know, react to things that the other team is doing in certain highly effective and efficient ways, rather than producing those situations through possession. That is something that may not scale at the very highest level. And seems right, but like it's this sort of weird thing that is very hard to demonstrate because of the limited number of places it can be demonstrated.
Yeah, I feel like we're just kind of seeing the long effects of wealth and talent being concentrated at a small number of clubs. Like Unai Emery has done exceptionally well at Villa, but teams do not perceive Villa in the same way that they perceive Liverpool. Like, if they're good for the next three or four years, we'll probably see managers looking at the fixture list and thinking, oh my God, we've got Villa next week. We need to change everything we're doing and plan for this. But, right, I'm not sure that's happening to the same extent that it's happening with Liverpool right now. And so therefore, I think it's a fundamentally different challenge. I don't think the techniques you would apply?
Yeah, I think Newcastle, right, over the last two seasons is a pretty good example of this. I mean, I think we spent a lot of time during Newcastle's very, very good season discussing, like, it just sort of seems like they are really benefiting from teams not treating them like a very, very good team. And then they spent half
the
season.
It's the Leicester title.
Yeah, the Leicester title as well. I mean, although, I like, the Leicester title itself, like, they just ran stupid hot, like even beyond.
I always remember there was like a game with like a month left to go where suddenly they were playing against a Sam Allardyce team who had like clearly planned for Leicester and they weren't entirely sure what to do. Like, they hadn't faced that all season. I mean, the Premier League is like the standard of coaching, I think, is a bit more than a bit better now than it was in 2016, but there's still like a perception difference based on the opponent you're facing. There's an amount of time you're going to be spending in training during the week against Manchester City that you're going to spend trying to nullify Manchester City, that if you're playing Burnley, you're just going to do what you're doing.
Yeah, there's a pretty binary idea of like, are we going to prioritize doing what we do or are we going to prioritize stopping what you do? And when you cross over that threshold, it changes what you have to do as a manager. So, like, do we think that that's something Arne Slot is prepared to do as we now come to the guy who's actually going to be the Liverpool manager?
I mean, like, he clearly has ideas of what he wants to do in possession. Like he's not a guy who wants to be counter-attacking all the time. Like, I think the concern is that his ideas aren't especially complex. He seems to prioritize, you know, getting the ball out wide and then having really good players do things out wide that lead to scoring goals. You know, his team seems to put a lot of crosses in, a lot of long shots, but though I'm judging him quite harshly there, but like, if you were, like, if we're sitting here in a year's time and it hasn't worked out and he's sacked, I would suspect that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, so it's probably worth talking a bit about Feyenoord, who won the Eredivisie last year, did not win the Eredivisie this year, but the expected goal difference between them and Eindhoven, who walked the league, is very, very slight. It is, you know, based on the underlying numbers, based on a whole bunch of different things, the goal difference as well. It is an Eindhoven-Feyenoord Eredivisie. And it was, you know, it was Feyenoord this season, it's PSV. And so
PSV are historically a much richer team. I don't have the numbers to hand, but I would imagine their budget is significantly larger to build this squad.
So yeah, doing it on somewhat more of a shoestring, and doing it with a team that, like, wants to have a lot of the ball and move it into the penalty area. But I think, as Grace is saying, especially last season, they led the league in crosses played into the penalty area.
I should say I've just pulled up Swiss Ramble now. It's almost exactly like the Eredivisie 2022 and 2023, PSV and Feyenoord are almost identical. So I wasn't quite right on that.
Okay, but it's still a big gap from them to Ajax, which is funny in context. So last season, they have been a team in both seasons that is near the top of the league in crosses played. Last season, they were basically in a top group with Ajax and Twente, and this season they are a little below the very top in crosses play with Eindhoven ahead of them. But like, they move the ball forward a lot. They move the ball forward wide a lot. And then they get into the penalty area a ton. And, you know, all indicate, you know, the like gap between Eindhoven and Feyenoord and the rest of the league in touches in the attacking penalty area, it's like a 25% gap down to the next best team. And this was similar last season. All of these indicators of a pretty of a style that prioritizes possession and getting the ball forward. And I think, you know, exactly how to, like, what's going to scale from the Eredivisie is really, really hard to understand. Like, you know, Erik ten Hag's team also had a whole bunch of good indicators in the Eredivisie. Like, it's not an easy thing to look at, but at least, like, you know.
But then he decided to not do any of the things he did at Ajax, so.
I will say that I think, like, other than the obvious jokes about bald Dutch managers coming to the Premier League, it is, like, fairly instructive to look at Den Haag, because as we were sort of talking about, he's not a guy that did not have ideas about what he wanted to do with the ball, about how he wanted to play possession football, about how he wanted to attack the problem of always sort of being prepared for and having the ball, to some degree, because, like, he came from Ajax, where every game in the Eredivisie was like, we prepare for Ajax. Also, those ideas didn't work. Or maybe those ideas could have worked in another lifetime, in another alternate timeline. I don't know. They did not work in the reality of being at Manchester United in the Premier League.
Yeah, but so I think, like, how much of his ideas were purely out of his own head? How much of his ideas was he able to implement because a lot of these Ajax players came from the academy and had, like, a lifetime of Ajax coaching? He didn't, like, whereas at Manchester United, like, he would need to taught them the basics of what he wanted to do. And he just seemed to decide he wasn't going to do that.
I think that's that's right. I also think that, like, Ajax obviously had a huge talent advantage in the Eredivisie, and so a lot of what he's leveraging with his ideas is, like, our players are better at doing the things of possession than our opponents are. But I think all of those issues are germane when thinking about Slot, right? Like, what are the things that will translate, and are you able to account for the things that won't translate when trying to develop your ideas? I have no ability to speak with any authority on where Slot sits in that constellation of challenges.
I mean, well, like, I think part of the Ten Hag problem is that people are not very impressed by him as a person. Like, he supposedly didn't get the Tottenham job because Daniel Levy met him and thought, nah, this, I don't know, I don't like this guy. Like, everyone who meets Slot seems to be convinced that he's the guy. I don't know, like, I don't think that should matter, but, like, it seems to be something players care about. If he can convince players to do his thing, then that's, like, that's half the battle. Like, it's what you said about Amorim before. Like, if maybe Ten Hag has good ideas, but no one's willing to do them. If Slot can find the right combination of having ideas and convincing people to do them, then he might be onto something.
Yeah, and one of the things that is sort of just looks wild to look at in the numbers on Feyenoord, and to a certain degree, I think it's like just the Eredivisie, but like the numbers of guys on this team who have like 40, 50, 60 take-on attempts is wild. Like, everybody is trying to beat a defender, and not a ton of them are like super efficient at it. Which, I mean, you wouldn't want to be your whole team to be too super efficient at it. That means you're probably not doing it enough. But it does seem, and like from the few Feyenoord games that I've watched, that like he really likes to have players in positions to try to beat a defender. And that a lot of the like good stuff comes, there's a way you get to a good place to try to beat the defender, and then you do it. And he's got it sort of comes from everywhere on the team.
I would say that would make me a little bit nervous, because one of the fairly notable things about the Eredivisie, and it has been now for decades, is the degree of man marking as opposed to structured defenses that you see. And so it is a much easier proposition to have an attack built on having your guys go one-on-one. It is harder in the Premier League because you have structured defenses which issue cover. Now, because you have structured defenses which issue cover, there are other things you can do that you could not do in primarily man-marking systems, right? Like the manipulation of space that you see that Premier League teams can do to exploit defenses is a real thing. And it is a real thing that has sort of expanded from Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp, sort of cascading down among Premier League managers. But it's hard to get ISOs. Like, it's just hard to get ISOs in the Premier League as compared to other leagues, I think. And the last thing I'd say here is, like, I think that what we've seen with good managers, like, say, Areola, was an adjustment period where he realized this and, you know, adapted the tactics to take it into account. And I sort of feel like the first test for Slot is going to be, well, can he do that thing?
Yeah. Is he deliberately doing that in Feyenoord, or is he just dealing with the reality of the Eredivisie, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Like if he inherits this Liverpool squad, like, I don't, like, is his plan just going to be let Luis Diaz dribble past a bunch of people? Because, like, that would seem pretty weird. Like, I don't know. Like, there are a lot of questions that I don't think anyone can know the answer to yet.
I will say, like, if anybody deserves the benefit of the doubt in terms of hiring process, that, like, they may have been aware of these concerns and insisted that a manager address them in the interview process and evaluation process. It does seem like Liverpool would be the team that has the you know, that you give the benefit of the doubt to in this area.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, if we were asked what sporting director or executive would we want to lead a process like this, I think we'd all probably say Michael Edwards. Like, that's, like, I don't know. There's no one, like, it's Patriots in control. There's no one you would want making these decisions more.
Also, they've never had to do this. Like, the last time they did this, they went and got the best manager that everybody knew was the best manager and, like, hired him. And, like, the thing they did was, like, oh, yeah, right, he's the best manager. Let's make sure we get rid of Brendan Rodgers now to make sure we can get this guy.
Well, they did the famous thing where they looked at the expected goal difference and found that Dortmund were actually fine. So,
yeah. Like,
That seems good, but that, I think that kind of seems obvious to us, but it wasn't obvious at the time to a lot of people.
I suppose that's true.
Yeah, and like, I mean, this is, I think, the like larger context here, which is that Liverpool still have a process advantage, but it's not like, you know, they were in like the Moneyball situation of calling up the dumb GMs and waiting for them to mention the good player so that they could like figure out the cheapest bargain they could get on that player. Like, Mo Salah is not coming for that money anymore when he's putting up those sorts of underlying numbers at a good club in Serie A. And so they are just playing a harder game now. And it certainly seems like they are playing that harder game well, but they're playing it a little bit differently at the same time. And I think that Slot is a somewhat is a different kind of hire in the same way that like Luis Diaz and Darwin Nunez are different kinds of signings. And we're seeing like what exactly is a Liverpool 2.0 vision.
Well, but arguably they stopped doing that and changed their process right around when Michael Edwards left. Maybe it's just a personnel question, and now we're going to see them try and make those same decisions again, and maybe they'll find it harder, or maybe it just still works. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. That could have been a too early adjustment, or simply a different people in charge adjustment, and Slot is now part of a return to form, or a third version. And like all of these things, I think another part of this is that it is tough to evaluate a manager, not only based on their Eredivisie numbers, not only not having seen their team in the Premier League, but also like not really knowing exactly what Liverpool want to be next season.
We don't even know if Salah's going to be there or not.
Exactly.
Like that, I would, in terms of projecting performance expectations in the next 12 months, I would argue that probably matters more than whether Slot is a good manager.
Yeah, I think no question about it. My sort of like really vague mental frame, and someone would need to do a study to demonstrate this, there's some studies in the NBA that kind of push at this angle, is I think about a manager as like, think about them in terms of the value that a star can have. Like a superstar manager is good. A superstar player gets you wins, gets you a bunch of extra points. And so if you're going to go from Mo Salah, one of the best players in the world, to hope the next guy is good, you're going to lose points. And like something similar is going to happen when you're going to go from Jurgen Klopp, one of the best managers in the world, to Arne Slot, hope this guy is good. Like it's a similar kind of effect size is sort of broadly my way of thinking about it, to say that like managers have a really big effect, but in the same way that putting Mo Salah on Nottingham Forest wouldn't put Nottingham Forest in the Champions League, like there's a limit to the size of the effect.
But like, okay, here's a hypothetical. Like, all right, no, like we saw Liverpool sign these guys who were undervalued, who put up big metrics, right? If he didn't already play for Liverpool, would Michael Edwards be trying to sign Darwin Nunez this summer?
That's a really good question. And Nunez is obviously the fascinating one because, right, he was the one who, when he was signed, had tons of air in his numbers. And then he shows up at Liverpool and gets, like, immediately the script is flipped on what he is and is not. But we said at the time that he was not what you would consider to be a typical Liverpool signing in any capacity.
Yeah, and now, exactly as Grace is saying, he would be. Now he's like the most obvious Liverpool signing in the world if they could like steal him away from some other club where he'd been putting up 4.7 shots per 90.
It is kind of wild. The other thing here, and I think this goes to what we're sort of talking about in terms of process, replacing Jurgen Klopp, what is the goal for the manager? Are you trying to hire the next guy to be there for 7-8 years to like be the face of this club forever? Or like, is your vision as Michael Edwards, as the management team here, like, yeah, you know, like we'll get 2 or 3 years if this works out with Slot, and then we'll bring in the next guy. Or like, you know, maybe he'll be okay, but not great. That's what our expectation should be. Like, what is the framework within which we should think about like what Liverpool are doing here with a manager? Like, because Klopp to me is somebody who was, for a lot of reasons, outside of what you would think the Liverpool view of how a manager should work might be.
I suspect obviously they want the best manager possible, but I suspect internally they would not be heartbroken if Slot never reached a position to amass as much internal power as Klopp. I think Richard Hughes would not want to see Slot become so powerful that he pushes him out the door.
That seems like, you know, sensible self-preservation.
Yeah, I think within that structure, I suspect they would not, like, I don't think Liverpool are ever going to go back to having an all-powerful manager after this. Like, I don't see the Klopp structure being recreated unless Arne Slot is the best manager in the world.
Yeah, I think that is quite likely. I think that sort of the interesting question is sort of where in the middle ground this falls. Like, you know, say that Arne Slot is, it turns out, like one of the new generation of the best manager in the world, and we're going to add him into the conversation at the very top, and that's a good problem to have. You like it is a problem for Richard Hughes, for Michael Edwards. I said saying Michael Scott for Michael Edwards and Richard Hughes and various people in the hierarchy of Liverpool, that if you happen to end up with one of the best managers in the world, you're going to have to give them more power within your structure, and you're going to have to figure that out. But like, Liverpool are happy to have had that problem over the last several seasons. Won trophies, everyone had a great time. Now we got to figure out the next thing. Like, that's a great problem to have. But if that doesn't happen, like, what exactly is the vision for Slot? Like, he's a good manager and we get some trophies and we stick with him for a while. He's a good manager and we don't get some trophies and someone else comes along. We kind of like them a little better. We move on. Like, I think that, like, that medium-term planning is an interesting question of, like, what you're committing. And as you're going through an off-season process, like, and this goes back to the Amorim thing, that like, if you're only like halfway committing to a manager, which I think in pretty much any case, you just have to be no more than halfway committing to a manager, and you then make a bunch of signings to fit the 3-4-3, you set yourself up with a lot less flexibility for whatever comes next. And I think that like, it'll be interesting to see how much of their signings are like flexible to many different outcomes of Slot.
I think it's much more the if someone better comes along in 2 or 3 years, they'll move. Like, I think FSG as an organization are not particularly sentimental. Like, I don't see a world in which, you know, if a Jurgen Klopp ability manager came along, they wouldn't just cut their ties and go for it.
Yeah, and I do think that that makes a bit of a mismatch right now. Like, I think replacing Jurgen Klopp is something that looms really large in the world of Liverpool, because Jurgen Klopp looms really large in the world of Liverpool. And so there's like, just obviously, I mean, you know, we're doing a podcast on it. There's tons of attention on it. There's tons of interest in it because it's replacing a legend. But Like, I agree. What they're doing here is not that. What they're doing here, I suspect, is actively trying not to replace a legend. And that is probably the correct decision. Yeah,
no, it's like when they sold Coutinho, they didn't buy another numbered creative playmaker. They bought, they strengthened areas that were weak and bought a bunch of players. Like, that's, they're thinking about this in the same way they thought of that. They're looking at it as, okay, Jurgen Klopp was almost the entire footballing structure, blank slate, what are we building?
Yeah, and it's interesting thinking about it that way ahead of what will eventually be a replacement for Mo Salah, I assume, conducted along fairly similar lines.
I mean, though, thinking about Slot tactically, if he relies a lot on getting the ball to wingers and expecting wingers to do really good things, then he probably would like Salah to be playing for Liverpool.
That's true. I mean, I think that there are very few managers in the world who would actively really want what Ant Postecoglou had last season, where you come in and your big player goes out. And then
Ant Postecoglou was only replacing Antonio Conte, who everyone seemed to hate right at the end of this. If Postecoglou had come into Liverpool replacing Klopp and Salah was gone, I think that would be a high-pressure situation.
Yeah.
It's very... You can't replicate, how bad things went at Tottenham, and you wouldn't want to have, even though it makes it a lot easier for the next manager to come in and get a mulligan on the next season. And, it seems relatively unlikely that Liverpool are going to...
Yeah, I mean, you look on social media and stuff, Liverpool fans have become used to winning. There are a lot of people who have forgotten what it was like watching this team under Brendan Rodgers and Kenny Dalglish. There is now an expectation to see this team winning all the time that may or may not be unrealistic. And, Slot may well get a lot of the personal blame for that if things suddenly aren't as good.
Yeah, and at the same time, maybe next season they still have Mo Salah. Maybe next season they still have Virgil van Dijk. But in time, they will not have those guys, whether because they move them on or because they cease to be what they presently are. And that's just a thing that that is the big problem, much more so than this particular managerial signing, I think, that Edwards and Hughes have to figure out.
Well, and the reporting around Edwards was that one of the reasons he decided to leave in the first place was because the club sided with Jurgen Klopp and gave out long-term contracts to all the players. So since Edwards is now apparently in full control, FSG have just said, okay, you're the guy making all the decisions at Liverpool. I think his decisions are going to align heavily with not holding on to these players forever, moving on, changing the team.
Okay, well, let me ask another slightly uncomfortable question then. Are we sure we want to put Liverpool's generation of success down to FSG and not Jurgen Klopp? That's the other half of this. To take a brief baseball walk here. Everybody has seen Moneyball and Billy Beane at the A's, but there's an alternate way of telling that story. And the alternate way of telling that story is that Billy Beane walked into a team and ended up with three really, really good starting pitchers at the primes of their careers. And that all the names of guys that Billy Beane discovered that were sort of used in Moneyball did not actually amount to particularly impactful Major League Baseball players. And that had they not had Barry Zito and Tim Hudson and Mark Mulder leading the pitching staff for that team, all the Moneyball stuff in the world would not have gotten them where they got. So to what degree, how confident are you that handing this back over to Michael Edwards in the absence of Jurgen Klopp is actually going to be successful in terms of process?
I mean, at the same time, this was the thing. If you look at some of the players who were rumored to be on lists of players Liverpool targeted and didn't end up signing, some of them were not quite as good as the players they ended up signing. How much of it just kind of worked out? You know, if If Southampton had decided to be really difficult about Virgil van Dijk and just said, we are not selling you this player because you tat him up, then does this Liverpool team become particularly good? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's a hard question. And like, I don't want to, I am obviously invested in the methods that Liverpool use to run their side. I obviously think that these are good things that all smart clubs should implement and they make their team better. I just also like, that doesn't make them foolproof is the thing I keep coming back to. And there is inherently risk in doing all of this. And, you know, like the thing that sits in the back of my head a lot is right when we were getting started in soccer and analytics, like right when, it was, Luis Suarez is getting sold from Liverpool and Gareth Bale getting sold from Tottenham. And there was like this animating debate among people doing at sort of the nascent analytics work. Like, might you be better off selling a star and distributing that money among a lot of players to raise the level of your team? And we got like a real life experiment in Gareth Bale particularly, but also Luis Suarez. And the answer was kind of like, no. Like, the value that the star brings in some way adds value to the club that just replacing them with, you know, in the aggregate, as is clipped all over the internet.
Okay, I'll ask you, like, yeah. I don't know much about baseball, so I'll ask you this question. In baseball, is it not the case that because it's the way the sport is structured, a good player is kind of going to be a good player anyway? Whereas, like, it, and especially because, like, I would think most of those guys are already American and they're not going to have huge off-field adaptation issues to perhaps quite the same extent. Like,
less so, but not entirely so.
I don't know. It seems to me that if you have lots of good baseball players, you're going to be good at baseball. It seems like the number of variables in constructing a team is smaller.
Yeah, I basically think of it in terms of Jurgen Klopp. Like, is he just irreplaceable in terms of what a front office can do absent having Jurgen Klopp? And so, like, we're sort of talking a little bit about, you know, the process is getting improved because Klopp took over so much power that it degraded a lot of the processes they were doing. And I think all of that is true. I'm just sort of wondering if, like, you're also losing all of the things that Jurgen Klopp did as a singular talent.
Well, it's like Barcelona moving on from Messi. Like, okay, you can have a more balanced side, but, you know, just giving the ball to Messi and expecting him to do loads of good stuff is probably going to be better than whatever normal team you put out with the other players.
Right, and they're probably going to, over time, lose Salah and Van Dijk, and replacing them will be non-trivial, and they probably will not, on the first stab, replace them, although maybe Nunez is, and that's just going to do it. But, like, I feel like the similar thing is probably going to happen with the manager. You know, it's just going to be a little bit worse and a little bit harder. And that's usually what happens with these sorts of things. Like, and you get a couple stabs, maybe it takes you, rather than 1 year, it takes you 3 years. And, you know, that's just the cycle of things, and we got very used to there not being a cycle because Liverpool had this and because there's also Pep at Man City. But, like, I just think Man City's going to start cycling once they lose Pep. Like, that's, and they're already possibly, like, not quite as good as they were.
I don't know. I mean, it depends on how much money you think they have and how much they're actually going to spend. But like I felt for a while that teams with actual material budgets cannot be good all the time. Like, Liverpool, financially speaking, cannot be good all the time. They're going to have to accept that they're going to be good sometimes and not so good other times. Like, in 5 years' time, we'll probably be talking about Arsenal questioning whether they can keep, they might enter more of a lean period. And that's just the reality of having to pay the bills in the real world.
Yeah, you just have to get more things right. Like, you have to more frequently get slightly worse bets correct when you don't have unlimited resources.
But no, but like, at the same time, like, you have to target your signings in a certain age bracket to be able to compete within a certain window. You know, maybe in like 2018, Liverpool were willing to gamble on a PKH player to boost the chances of the side winning the title. Whereas if they're looking at players this summer, I don't think they should be spending much money on PKH players at all.
I mean, I think Thiago's the perfect example of this, right? Of like a guy that they brought in to extend and sort of elevate the peak of a window that obviously makes the team better, but like you're not going to do in all sort of periods of the cycle.
There has to be an expectance that Liverpool are going to go through some kind of rebuilding period. In fact, I mean, I think there was an acceptance of that last summer, but then the team just did well and won loads of games, and everyone thought it was fixed. And maybe that's a little premature, and we're still in the rebuilding phase of the cycle.
All right. Well, I feel like that is a excellent place to leave it. Grace, thank you so much for joining us. And do you want to tell people about the Grace on Football newsletter? I hear it's a great place to hear about the latest happenings in the game of football and some smart analysis of it.
Yeah, great. GraceOnFootball.com. Lots of articles about football.
I believe I read in a major newspaper that it is the place to go if you're a football fan that wants to read about tactics.
I believe that's it. I can't comment on the quality of some of the other things that newspaper publishes, but on that fact, they seem to know what they're doing.
Well, they nailed that one.
All right, we'll be back later this week with more podcasts. Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.